Hello and welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. This month, we are speaking to Professor David Dodwell, who has co-authored an editorial piece in our journal titled Doing More with Less: Are There Some Easy Wins in the Management of Early Breast Cancer? Professor Dodwell is a consultant medical oncologist based at Leeds Cancer Centre, and this article comes out of a debate he was part of at last year's NCRI conference. I started by asking him why that debate took place.
The debate was organised by Breast Cancer Now, and it happened at the NCRI meeting in November 2016. And Professor Robert Coleman in Sheffield and I were asked to be involved by Judith Bliss, who chaired the meeting. And it seemed to Judith and to Breast Cancer Now that there was perhaps a tension between the importance of developing new interventions and the increasing emphasis on precision medicine to do that. But also at the same time, perhaps we were neglecting to use the treatments already at our disposal to their full effect in appropriate circumstances. So the notion of the debate was to see what the audience felt after listening to the arguments for either deploying resources towards the development of new drugs, targeted drugs, translational research, precision medicine, those things, or whether resources could be better directed perhaps towards methods that we might consider to make better use of the treatments that we already have at our disposal. And that was the debate, and I think it was a very appropriate one, and I was happy to be involved. Now, who won the debate is a matter of some discussion. Ultimately, the new drug ideas got the most votes, but Professor Coleman and I managed to swing the most votes afterwards. So at the beginning, it was very much against us. After we'd finished, we narrowly lost, but we swung more votes than they did. So we think we won and they think they won, but I'll leave that up to your listeners. So that's where it came from. And I was approached by Sherlock Holmes in clinical oncology to see if I would consider writing this up as an editorial. And Rob Coleman and I and two colleagues from Breast Cancer Now were involved in this, and it just sets out our side of the arguments that were articulated in that debate.
What would you say are the most compelling arguments on your side of the debate?
I think that there is unquestionably improvements in current care that can happen. I think it's hard to say which one the most important is, but you've only got to look at some of the audit information that comes along to show there are big variabilities in some of the treatments that are provided. Now, I'm very much involved in the breast cancer screening audit, and we've shown in that audit, and again within the Sloan project, that there are big differences geographically in the use of radiotherapy, both for invasive disease and also for in situ disease, across the country, and big differences that have occurred over time. And that variability is really much more than can be explained by case mix. It really is MDTs making very different decisions. And it's rather hard to justify that state of affairs continuing. So I think that there are unquestioned, and the harder you look, the more variability you find. So the breast cancer screening audit is a very powerful tool to look at variations in care, and they are very considerable. There are others as well, but that's probably the main one that I was considering. So I think addressing variability in care is one thing. I mean, another example is the variability in applications to the Cancer Drugs Fund. Now, this is something that, of course, doesn't just affect breast cancer, but other diseases as well. If you look geographically, the National Audit did a review of this, and on a population basis, the variation in applications is threefold. So in some parts of the country, there are a third CDF applications happening, and this is by head of population, of course, than there are in other parts of the country. So there are really very different views and considerations going on out there in oncological practice, and no doubt in surgical practice as well. So I think that there are variations in care that can be addressed. to the improvement in population level health as it applies to breast cancer. That's one issue. Probably the dominant issue, though, is the difficulty and struggle that everyone has had to make adjuvant bisphosphonates available for appropriate patients with early breast cancer. Since the work of Rob Coleman and the Early Breast Cancer Trialist Collaborative Group in Oxford, we're now very clear that these drugs do modestly but significantly improve outcomes in terms of bone metastasis, in terms of recurrence-free and breast cancer survival, that all of these factors are improved by the use of adjuvant bisphosphonates. And despite the fact that these drugs are cheap, and in comparison to some other treatments that oncologists use, relatively non-toxic, it's been a huge struggle to make these available to women with early breast cancer in the UK. And there's lots of reasons behind that. One is that the drugs were never, of course, licensed or originally patented for this particular indication. And because of that, it's been very difficult for NICE to review the problem. And there's a lot of dialogue between central government, central commissioning, and local commissioning to actually try and understand where the responsibility for making this treatment available lies. And it's been extremely frustrating and very puzzling for the breast cancer charities and for patients themselves that we've known about this for, I guess, a couple of years now. And in many parts of the country, these drugs are still not routinely available. And of course, we do have that looming problem that there are some parts of the country where they are available. So we've got a postcode situation that seems to have evolved. And that's really very hard to manage and to understand. And I think a priority is to try and improve this situation for the future. So if another new simple intervention comes along, and many of these drugs, you know, about the work going on in statins, all the work going on in metformin and aspirin, the similar issues will arise with those so-called repurposed drugs if the clinical trials confirm efficacy and there's an acceptable risk-benefit ratio to make these drugs available or to recommend that they be used. So it's been monumentally difficult to get these drugs available. And that, I think, probably of all of the issues that we wanted to raise is probably the most dominant.
To look at that a little bit in more detail, so you described about the benefits of using bisphosphonates in postmenopausal women with early breast cancer, and some of the figures you give in your editorial in terms of it could save about 1,000 deaths per year, and the cost is only about 43 pence a day. So you're saying that it's quite puzzling to the community why it hasn't been taken on board, but what are the kind of thoughts as to the reasons behind the lack of adoption?
Well, because nobody seems to know who is in charge. That's the fundamental difficulty. Central commissioning, local commissioning is not particularly well joined up. NICE can't approve it or disapprove it because it's outside license. So outside license things always are problematic in a number of places. I'm afraid that there's also a tension very often between primary care and what goes on in the secondary sector, because these are drugs that could, particularly obviously oral bisphosphonates, one would expect predominantly to be prescribed and dispensed within primary care once treatment has been initiated in local breast units. So there are probably three or four different factors why this has been such a problem. And, you know, we're now 2 years on and it's still a struggle. Now, within the UK Breast Cancer Group, or UK relatively recently formed organisation that encompasses professionals in medical and clinicians in both clinical and medical oncology who specialise in breast cancer, this has been taken on, and my colleague Catherine Harper-Wynn has been very assistant and vocal in trying to sort this problem out. But it ends up being very much a local battle involving hospitals, the CCGs, and the primary care prescribers. And it's even in my neck of the woods in Leeds, it's not completely sorted out at this point in time. So it is a great difficulty.
You said that obviously it's important to learn for next time. So what do you think can be done tangibly to prevent something like this happening again?
I think that there needs to be a discussion politically in the Department of Health about how we take forward drugs that slip between the net for different reasons. And that seems to particularly apply to drugs that are outside license. There are other issues as well, orphan drugs. There's a whole rag bag of problems that things just don't fit into a neat silo. And there has to be a much more joined up way of approaching this so that we can all talk from the same hymn sheet when this happens in the future. I don't have a clear and crisp answer, but it's something that I think once politically things have calmed down a little bit, does need to be taken forward.
And just a final thought on that. Clearly, this is something that does have a negative impact on breast cancer patients as a whole. Do you think women in the wider public are aware of this? Is there a lack of awareness out there? Because obviously that can form an important way of lobbying authoritative figures.
I don't know is the answer. I have had relatively few, probably a handful of individual contacts from patients out there. Others tell a similar picture. I think some people have had more, some have had fewer. I think that the reality is that you get this sort of bubble of reaction and interest when things hit the media, as they did. This has hit the media perhaps two or three times after the last 2 years. I think that people do contact their consultants and their GPs at that point in time, but I think that the next thing comes along and things sort of tail off a little bit, really. It's not for patients necessarily to have to chase this. It's for healthcare services to be more consistent in their approach to these problems.
Absolutely. We've looked at those benefits with bisphosphonates, and you were earlier talking about real variability in terms of clinical practice. So again, looking at how we can address that, what are the kind of methods that can be used to accomplish that?
I think that the tool to do that is audit. The audit has to be supported. Most of us who work in the secondary care and primary care sectors do not have the opportunity or the time to collect data manually. That's just not going to happen. So the processes have to be slick and straightforward and independent of clinical activities. We do happily have an increasingly large range of data sets that routinely pick up data. We've got the PHE held data sets, and there are many of these. COSD is possibly the most important, but there are others that collect radiotherapy data and drug therapy data. There are many others, and these can be linked up by the NHS number, and it is possible and increasingly becoming the case that you can do pretty thorough audits, not in real time because of the lag of data flow, but not far away from real time. It is important that these audits are supported. It is important that everybody embraces the need for good quality data. COSD, I think, is probably the most relevant and important data source currently. And you've got to make these things meaningful for clinicians. There's no point doing audit that just serves a bureaucratic or financial contracting role. It has to be clinically relevant. And if it is clinically relevant and clinicians can see outputs that they can identify with and understand and they believe are accurate in the reflection of their activities, I think that those would be supported from a clinical viewpoint. If you have a burdensome bureaucratic process where clinicians are ticking boxes or filling in forms and are suspicious that the data is nothing more than to be used for contracting, and in any case it will be 5 years before it ever sees the light of day, then there will be skepticism and disengagement and things will be much less successful. So I think that there are some messages. I think at the same time, clinicians can't look at audit information and say, oh, it's all wrong, and then refuse to engage with the data collection processes. I think it's important that in MDTs and in governance meetings, M&M meetings, all the audit meetings that happen within trusts, that it's important that clinicians make themselves aware of what data collection is going on and the quality of it and how it's happening, so that they have an opportunity to shape it and influence it, but they're not there to collect the data. It then needs to be turned around and turned into something meaningful that can affect their practice. Of course, one example of this is what we put in the paper that we published from the SAC database on early mortality, which is mentioned in the review article that we've been discussing, and that's early mortality that occurs following palliative chemotherapy. Now, that's very meaningful and important data. And that, I think, it will be a useful wake-up call to the clinical community that these data sets can be used. When clinicians are involved in interpretation of the data and putting it into context, that these outputs can be turned into products which are really clinically very meaningful and can be used in governance processes in local trusts to consider changes to clinical practice. I think if it's just a tick-box exercise, no one's going to buy in.
So you've raised some really important points already on what's covered within the article. Are there any other things that you really want readers to take away from it?
We do need to address the issue of compliance and the use of endocrine therapies, both for prevention and also in the treatment of invasive disease. We've got issues with compliance and adherence, which we discuss in the article. And there is also, I think, the issue of the underutilization of endocrine therapy and chemo prevention. Now, a lot of that is due to toxicity issues or perceived toxicity issues, but there may well be things that can be done to address that. And I think that that's probably a more challenging problem. But as we make the point in the article, we use drugs in a prevention setting or secondary or sometimes primary prevention in cardiovascular disease, in cerebrovascular disease, and in other areas of medicine. And compliance is generally high. Uptake of these treatments is high. For chemo prevention, when you've got treatment that will reduce the risk of disease by 30 or 40%, that seems to me to be very significant. And yet these drugs are significantly underutilized. People often say, well, it's toxicity. But I think it's largely untested. And despite these trials of chemo prevention, it is surprising that in all cultures, it's not just the UK, it's the US as well, that there's a relatively poor uptake. I think some of that may simply be due to the expectation in many areas that a lot of this has to be managed in primary care. And with the best will in the world, very generalist GPs, I think, will potentially struggle to be able to cope with all the nuances of this kind of prescribing. But we just can't manage this problem in a secondary care setting, I'm afraid. That's the reality. Breast cancer is far too common and too prevalent to be able really to comprehensively have an outpatient clinical load. Follow-up in breast cancer, as I'm sure you know, has diminished very significantly over the last 5 or 10 years. A lot of that is very good, but it does mean missing out on potential options to look at compliance, to address toxicities, and also to consider the option of extended endocrine therapy in women previously treated with invasive disease. So that's a problem. Again, I don't have a solution for it. I'm clear that the solution is not bringing back thousands of breast cancer survivors to big clinics in the hospital sector. Those days are gone, and they're not going to come back. But we are potentially missing a few opportunities because of that, and I think how we're going to pick that up again, I think, is going to be a real challenge. I don't have an easy answer.
I guess at this point, just to go on to, obviously, there were two sides on that debate, and so hearing from the other side who are advocating more translational medicine and first-line medicine-based trials, what do you think was the strongest point that they brought to the table?
The strongest point is the hope and expectation that we will be able to deliver effective, highly targeted and low toxicity treatments. And that's, of course, the holy grail. You know, you subtype your breast cancer, you find that it's some type of breast cancer that responds well to a highly targeted treatment, that treatment can be used with low toxicity and is very effective in that patient group. And that's the attraction. There are many downsides. One is the biostatistics that accompany the identification of active treatments is very challenging indeed. And the reality is that you cannot expect to be doing large randomized trials in tiny subgroups of diseases. You just can't do that. The patients will not be out there. And that means you are in risky territory unless you have treatments which are much more than modestly effective. They have to be very effective. They have to be as effective as highly active antiretroviral therapy in AIDS, for instance, where you don't need a randomized trial to show efficacy, because otherwise you could make mistakes in the implementation of these treatments. So if you've got modestly effective treatments, you're in very dangerous territory in terms of proving their efficacy. You've got the problems of pharma being asked to develop niche products for small groups of patients. Their population of patients is small, so the remunerative issues, the financial strategy and dynamics are very different than treatments that can be used in very large populations, so that can be very challenging. And you've got the huge complication of understanding the molecular pathology of these diseases. So there's a long, long way to go with personalized medicine. It will be wonderful if it happens, but it's not quite ready. Well, it's a long way from being ready from prime time. And we make the example, as you may have read in the review, that you know, here we are now 10 years after the introduction of trastuzumab, and we still, at this point in the UK, still only have trastuzumab and, of course, endocrine therapy as the two available targeted adjuvant therapies. There are others in secondary disease, of course, but in the adjuvant context, we've only got trastuzumab for HER2-directed disease. We have endocrine therapy. We have nothing else that's near being able to be used for a breast cancer with a specific molecular phenotype where one can target this treatment appropriately. So there's a lot of airtime. There's a lot of oxygen that precision medicine is consuming. And, of course, the thing I haven't mentioned yet is the fiendishly high cost of some of these things. So those are all the reasons, I think, why, yes, it's important. And, of course, we're not saying let's stop doing it. I think we're saying that we mustn't ignore the simple stuff that can be done effectively and hopefully much more cheaply.
Yeah, thank you. And just to round things off, you mentioned about looking at sort of the adjuvant setting, and actually one way of looking at it with a more with less attitude is some of the trials such as the Optima and Primetime trial. So can you just briefly tell us what kind of questions those trials are looking to answer?
Well, I think one of the great difficulties is the trouble we have in addressing the massive problem in treating early breast cancer, which is, well, there's lots of massive problems. One is treatments aren't effective in large groups of women. But the other problem is that, of course, there's significant over-treatment that's going on. We're pouring endocrine therapy and chemotherapy and giving radiotherapy to big groups of patients who are actually cured by surgical treatment alone. And therefore, as individuals, those patients can only be suffering toxicity rather than benefit. So you have the problem of a situation that develops where drugs or intervention use are used widely, but then if you start to question whether you can subtract those treatments in certain circumstances, then that's difficult. It's difficult for lots of reasons. First of all, that thing called equipoise or clinical belief is very variable. The other problem is that the statistics of subtracting treatments seem to be more challenging and require more patients. And also, these are trials which are not often terribly sexy. Developing a wonderful new drug for breast cancer gets you on the platform at ASCO, gets you a paper in a high-impact journal telling the world that actually you can give trastuzumab for 6 months rather than 12 months is not going to set the world on fire, important though that finding is for the reduction of toxicity and certainly the reduction of cost. So these trials, which are important, the sort of supplementary trials, the subtraction trials, you know, asking questions, can we take a treatment away, are challenging for lots of different reasons, but they are still ultimately very important and do need to be supported. Of course, the other problem is there's very little commercial interest in these kind of exercises. It's hard to get pharma to support a study where, you know, you might be saying we only need your drug for 6 months of the year rather than 12 months. That's not attractive from a commercial proposition. So it's a challenge in a number of areas, but I think still terrifically important.
So on that note, Professor Dodwell, thank you very much for some really insightful comments. We've really learnt a lot and there's lots to ponder over. Thank you very much.
That's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening, and subscribe to our podcast for the simplest way to access next month's episode.